You are listening to KHDX 93.1 FM, Conway, Arkansas. This is the Ouroboros Diner, and I am your DJ and dinner companion, Drew. As you may be aware, if you've been keeping track of the days, we are, in fact, in October. Last year, for October, I read a few stories, one of which was The Murdered Cousin, by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, and that's still one of my favorite stories I've read, period, just in my life. It's a very, very good story. Not to put too much pressure on the story I'm about to read, but like that's the history that I'm coming into this with. But yeah, so I figured we'd go back to the good old tradition of a ghost story for Halloween. I guess Murdered Cousin wasn't a ghost story. It was a thriller. There was a murder. There was an attempted murder. It's a very good story. But anyway, today we're not reading Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu. Today we are reading Wilkie Collins, who you may be familiar, wrote The Moonstone, wrote one that's more famous, which I'm currently suddenly blinking on, The Woman in White. The Woman in White. This one is from quite a few, the one I'm about to read is from quite a few years after those novels. This was published in 1885. I believe originally, I don't actually know the format in which it was originally published. I found it looking in the short story compilation, Little Novels, Wilkie Collins, but I don't know if it was published by itself first. So, what we're reading today is Mrs. Zant and the Ghost. I'm not sure. I'm guessing we're not going to be able to finish it this week. It'll probably be next week, but I don't know. I might speed through it. Yeah, let's just get into it. Mrs. Zant and the Ghost by Wilkie Collins. Originally published in 1885. I don't think I actually said that. Okay. One. The course of this narrative describes the return of a disembodied spirit to Earth and leads the reader on new and strange ground. Not in the obscurity of midnight, but in the searching light of day, did the supernatural influence assert itself. Neither revealed by a vision nor announced by a voice, it reached mortal knowledge through the sense which is least easily self-deceived, the sense that feels. The record of this event will, of necessity, produce conflicting impressions. It will raise, in some minds, the doubt which reason asserts. It will invigorate, in other minds, the hope which faith justifies. And it will leave the terrible question of the destinies of man, where centuries of vain investigation have left it, in the dark. Having only undertaken in the present narrative to lead the way along a succession of events, the writer declines to follow modern examples by thrusting himself and his opinions on the public view. He returns to the shadow from which he has emerged, and leaves the opposing forces of incredulity and belief to fight the old battle over again on the old ground. 2. The events happened soon after the first 30 years of the present century had come to an end. On a fine morning, early in the month of April, a gentleman of middle age, named Rayburn, took his little daughter Lucy out for a walk in the woodland pleasure ground of western London called Kensington Gardens. The few friends whom he possessed reported of Mr. Rayburn, not unkindly, that he was a reserved and solitary man. He might have been more accurately described as a widower devoted to his only surviving child. Although he was not more than 40 years of age, the one pleasure which made life enjoyable to Lucy's father was offered by Lucy herself. Playing with her ball, the child ran on to the southern limit of the gardens, at that part of it which still remains nearest to the old palace of Kensington. Observing close at hand one of those spacious covered seats, called in England alcoves, Mr. Rayburn was reminded that he had the morning's newspaper in his pocket, and that he might do well to read and rest. At that early hour, the place was a solitude. "Go on playing, my dear," he said, "but take care to keep where I can see you." Lucy tossed up her ball, and Lucy's father opened his newspaper. He had not been reading for more than 10 minutes when he felt a familiar little hand laid on his knee. "Tired of playing?" he inquired, with his eyes still on the newspaper. "I'm frightened, Papa." He looked up directly. The child's pale face startled him. He took her on his knee and kissed her. "You oughtn't to be frightened, Lucy, when I'm with you," he said gently. "What is it?" He looked out of the alcove as he spoke and saw a little dog among the trees. "Is it the dog?" he asked. Lucy answered, "It's not the dog. It's the lady." The lady was not visible from the alcove. "Has she said anything to you?" Mr. Rayburn inquired. "No. What has she done to frighten you?" The child put her arms round her father's neck. "Whisper, Papa," she said. "I'm afraid of her hearing us. I think she's mad." "Why do you think so, Lucy?" "She came near to me. I thought she was going to say something. She seemed to be ill."
"Well, and then what?"
"She looked at me." There, Lucy found herself at a loss how to express what she had to say next, and took refuge in silence.
"Nothing very wonderful so far," her father suggested.
"Yes, Papa, but she didn't seem to see me when she looked."
"Well, and what happened then?"
"The lady was frightened, and that frightened me. I think," the child repeated positively, "she's mad."
It occurred to Mr. Rayburn that the lady might be blind. He rose at once to set the doubt at rest. "Wait here," he said, "and I'll come back to you." But Lucy clung to him with both hands. Lucy declared that she was afraid to be by herself. They left the alcove together. The new point of view at once revealed the stranger leaning against the trunk of a tree. She was dressed in the deep mourning of a widow. The pallor of her face, the glassy stare in her eyes, more than accounted for the child's terror. It excused the alarming conclusion at which she had arrived.
"Go nearer to her," Lucy whispered.
They advanced a few steps. It was now easy to see that the lady was young and wasted by illness, but, arriving at a doubtful conclusion, perhaps, under the present circumstances, apparently possessed of rare personal attractions in happier days. As the father and daughter advanced a little, she discovered them. After some hesitation, she left the tree, approached with an evident intention of speaking, and suddenly paused. A change to astonishment and fear animated her vacant eyes. If it had not been plain before, it was now beyond all doubt that she was not a poor blind creature, deserted and helpless. At the same time, the expression of her face was not easy to understand. She could hardly have looked more amazed and bewildered if the two strangers who were observing her had suddenly vanished from the place in which they stood. Mr. Rayburn spoke to her with the utmost kindness of voice and manner.
"I am afraid you are not well," he said. "Is there anything that I can do?"
The next words were suspended on his lips. It was impossible to realize such a state of things, but the strange impression that she had already produced on him was now confirmed. If he could believe his senses, her face did certainly tell him that he was invisible and inaudible to the woman who he had just addressed. She moved slowly away with a heavy sigh, like a person disappointed and distressed. Following her with his eyes, he saw the dog once more, a little smooth-coated terrier of the ordinary English breed. The dog showed none of the restless activity of his race. With his head down and his tail depressed, he crouched like a creature paralyzed by fear. His mistress roused him by a call. He followed her listlessly as she turned away. After walking a few paces only, she suddenly stood still. Mr. Rayburn heard her talking to herself.
"Did I feel it again?" she said, as if perplexed by some doubt that awed or grieved her.
After a while, her arms rose slowly and opened with a gentle caressing action, an embrace strangely offered to the empty air.
"No," she said to herself, sadly, after waiting a moment. "More, perhaps, when tomorrow comes. No more today."
She looked up at the clear blue sky.
"The beautiful sunlight. The merciful sunlight," she murmured. "I should have died if it had happened in the dark."
Once more she called to the dog, and once more she walked slowly away.
"Is she going home, Papa?" the child asked.
"We will try to find out," the father answered. He was by this time convinced that the poor creature was in no condition to be permitted to go out without someone to take care of her. For motives of humanity, he was resolved on making the attempt to communicate with her friends.
3.
The lady left the gardens by the nearest gate, stopping to lower her veil before she turned into the busy thoroughfare which leads to Kensington. Advancing a little way along the high street, she entered a house of respectable appearance, with a card in one of the windows which announced that apartments were to let. Mr. Rayburn waited a minute, then knocked at the door and asked if he could see the mistress of the house. The servant showed him into a room on the ground floor, neatly but scantily furnished. One little white object varied the grim brown monotony of the empty table. It was a visiting card. With a child's unceremonious curiosity, Lucy pounced on the card and spelled the name letter by letter.
"Z-A-N-T," she repeated. "What does that mean?"
Her father looked at the card as he took it away from her and put it back on the table. The name was printed and the address was added in pencil. "Mr. John's Aunt, Pearly's Hotel." The mistress made her appearance. Mr. Rayburn heartily wished himself out of the house again the moment he saw her. The ways in which it is possible to cultivate the social virtues are more numerous and more varied than is generally supposed. This lady's way had apparently accustomed her to meet her fellow creatures on the hard ground of justice without mercy. Something in her eyes, when she looked at Lucy, said, "I wonder whether that child gets punished when she deserves it."
"Do you wish to see the rooms which I have to let?" she began.
Mr. Rayburn at once stated the object of his visit, as clearly, as civilly, and as concisely as a man could do it. He was conscious, he added, that he had been guilty, perhaps, of an act of intrusion. The manner of the mistress of the house showed that she entirely agreed with him. He suggested, however, that his motive might excuse him. The mistress's manner changed and asserted a difference of opinion. "I only know the lady whom you mention," she said, "as a person of the highest respectability, in delicate health. She has taken my first-floor apartments with excellent references, and she gives remarkably little trouble. I have no claim to interfere with her proceedings, and no reason to doubt that she is capable of taking care of herself." Mr. Rayburn unwisely attempted to say a word in his own defense.
"Allow me to remind you," he began.
"Of what, sir?"
"Of what I observed.
When I happened to see the lady in Kensington Gardens."
"I am not responsible for what you observed in Kensington Gardens. If your time is of any value, pray don't let me detain you."
Dismissed in those terms, Mr. Rayburn took Lucy's hand and withdrew. He had just reached the door when it was opened from the outer side. The lady of Kensington Gardens stood before him. In the position which he and his daughter now occupied, their backs were toward the window. Would she remember having seen them for a moment in the gardens?
"Excuse me for intruding on you," she said to the landlady. "Your servant tells me my brother-in-law called while I was out. He sometimes leaves a message on his card."
She looked for the message and appeared to be disappointed. There was no writing on the card. Mr. Rayburn lingered a little in the doorway on the chance of hearing something more. The landlady's vigilant eyes discovered him. "Do you know this gentleman?" she said maliciously to her lodger.
"Not that I remember."
Replying in those words, the lady looked at Mr. Rayburn for the first time, and suddenly drew back from him.
"Yes," she said, correcting herself. "I think we met."
Her embarrassment overpowered her. She could say no more. Mr. Rayburn compassionately finished the sentence for her. "We met accidentally in Kensington Gardens," he said. She seemed to be incapable of appreciating the kindness of his motive. After hesitating a little, she addressed a proposal to him, which seemed to show distrust of the landlady.
"Will you let me speak to you upstairs in my own rooms?" she asked.
Without waiting for a reply, she led the way to the stairs. Mr. Rayburn and Lucy followed. They were just beginning the ascent to the first floor when the spiteful landlady left the lower room and called to her lodger over their heads. "Take care what you say to this man, Mrs. Zant. He thinks you're mad." Mrs. Zant turned round on the landing and looked at him. Not a word fell from her lips. She suffered, she feared, in silence. Something in the sad submission of her face touched the springs of innocent pity in Lucy's heart. The child burst out crying. That artless expression of sympathy drew Mrs. Zant down the few stairs which separated her from Lucy.
"May I kiss your dear little girl?" she said to Mr. Rayburn.
The landlady, standing on the mat below, expressed her opinion of the value of caresses as compared with a sounder method of treating young persons in tears. "If that child was mine," she remarked, "I would give her something to cry for." In the meantime, Mrs. Zan led the way to her rooms. The first words she spoke showed that the landlady had succeeded but too well in prejudicing her against Mr. Rayburn.
"Will you let me ask your child," she said to him, "why you think me mad?"
He met the strange request with a firm answer. "You don't know yet what I really do think. Will you give me a minute's attention?"
"No," she said positively. "The child pities me. I want to speak to the child. What did you see me do in the gardens, my dear, that surprised you?"
Lucy turned uneasily to her father. Mrs. Zant persisted.
"I first saw you by yourself, and then I saw you with your father," she went on. "When I came nearer to you, did I look very oddly, as if I didn't see you at all?"
Lucy hesitated again, and Mr. Rayburn interfered. "You are confusing my little girl," he said. "Allow me to answer your questions, or excuse me if I leave you." There was something in his look, or in his tone, that mastered her. She put her hand to her head.
"I don't think I'm fit for it," she answered vacantly.
"My courage has been sorely tried already. If I can get a little rest and sleep, you may find me a different person. I am left a great deal by myself, and I have reasons for trying to compose my mind. Can I see you tomorrow? Or write to you? Where do you live?" Mr. Rayburn laid his card on the table in silence. She had strongly excited his interest. He honestly desired to be of some service to this forlorn creature, abandoned so cruelly, as it seemed, to her own guidance. But he had no authority to exercise, no sort of claim to direct her actions, even if she consented to accept his advice. As a last resource, he ventured on an allusion to the relative of whom she had spoken downstairs. "When do you expect to see your brother-in-law again?" he said.
"I don't know," she answered. "I should like to see him again. He is so kind to me."
You're listening to KHDX 93.1 FM, Conway, Arkansas. This is the Ouroboros Diner. I am your DJ and dinner companion, Drew. And
Today we are reading Mrs. Van... Almost called her Mrs. Van Zant. That's a guy. Mrs. Zant and the Ghost by Wilkie Collins. We're really just at the intro, but there's a woman who... The protagonist, Mr. Rayburn, and his daughter, Lucy, saw in Kensington Gardens acting rather strangely, as if she couldn't see them. And they're now just meeting her. But we're taking a little break now, so I can rest my poor little throat for compare and contrast. So, originally, this was going to be between The Loneliest Time by Carly Rae Jepsen featuring Rufus Wainwright and The Loneliest by Måneskin. They were both released really recently, like within a few days of each other, so it seemed natural comparison. But I was doing one last listen through, and I realized that the storyline of The Loneliest Time kind of reminded me of Don't Shut Me Down by ABBA. So we're doing that one. We're doing that. So, yes. Sorry. I'm tired, if you can't tell. I came in rather late last night. Anyway. So, this is The Loneliest Time by Carly Rae Jepsen featuring Rufus Wainwright, headed right into Don't Shut Me Down by ABBA.
Had one. sound of children's laughter. Now it's quiet, so I guess they left the park. This wooden bench is getting harder by the hour. The sun is going down, it's getting dark. I realize I'm cold, the rain begins to pour as I watch the windows on the second floor. The lights are on, it's time to go. It's time at last to let him know.
Those were The Loneliest Time by Carly Rae Jepsen featuring Rufus Wainwright and Don't Shut Me Down by ABBA. I will also say of the abandoned comparison with The Loneliest by Måneskin, Carly Rae Jepsen and Måneskin, both fantastic music videos. Very different vibes, of course. If you're at all familiar with Måneskin, that wouldn't surprise you. But yeah, both highly recommended. I do enjoy a good music video, it must be said. All right, we're just gonna go straight back into the story. We're coming up on the only line of the story that I've highlighted. It's just, yeah, I say this all the time. I'm saying this constantly. Anyway, all right. I already gave the summary. I don't know why I did that before comparing contrast, actually. It's been a while since I've read something long on here. Forgive me. Okay.
When do you expect to see your brother-in-law again? He said. I don't know, she answered. I should like to see him. He is so kind to me. She turned aside to take leave of Lucy. Goodbye, my little friend. If you live to grow up, I hope you will never be such a miserable woman as I am. She suddenly looked round at Mr. Rayburn. Have you got a wife at home? She asked. My wife is dead. And you have a child to comfort you. Please leave me, you harden my heart. Oh, sir, don't you understand? You make me envy you. Mr. Rayburn was silent when he and his daughter were out at the street again. Lucy, as became a dutiful child, was silent too. But there are limits to human endurance, and Lucy's capacity for self-control gave way at last. Are you thinking of the lady, Papa? She said. He only answered by nodding his head. His daughter had interrupted him at that critical moment in a man's reflections when he's on the point of making up his mind. Before they were at home again, Mr. Rayburn had arrived at a decision. Mrs. Ant's brother-in-law was evidently ignorant of any serious necessity for his interference, or he would have made arrangements for immediately repeating his visit. In this state of things, if any evil happened to Mrs. Ant, the silence on Mr. Rayburn's part might be indirectly to blame for a serious misfortune. Arriving at that conclusion, he decided upon running the risk of being rudely received, for the second time, by another stranger. Leaving Lucy under the care of her governess, he went at once to the address that had been written on the visiting card left at the lodging house and sent in his name. A courteous message was returned. Mr. John Zand was at home and would be happy to see him. 4. Mr. Rayburn was shown into one of the private sitting rooms of the hotel. He observed that the customary position of the furniture in a room had been, in some respects, altered. An armchair, a side table, and a footstool had all been removed to one of the windows and had been placed as close as possible to the light. On the table lay a large open roll of Morocco leather, containing rows of elegant little instruments in steel and ivory. Waiting by the table stood Mr. John's aunt. He said, "Good morning," in a bass voice, so profound and so melodious that those two commonplace words assumed a new importance coming from his lips. His personal appearance was in harmony with his magnificent voice. He was a tall, finely made man of dark complexion, with his big, brilliant black eyes and a noble, curling beard, which hid the whole lower part of his face. Having bowed with a happy mingling of dignity and politeness, the conventional side of this gentleman's character suddenly vanished, and a crazy side, to all appearance, took its place. He dropped on his knees in front of the footstool. Had he forgotten to say his prayers that morning, and was he in such a hurry to remedy the fault that he had no time to spare for consulting appearances? The doubt had hardly suggested itself before it was set at rest in a most unexpected manner. Mr. Zant looked at his visitor with a bland smile and said, "Please let me see your feet." For the moment, Mr. Rayburn lost his presence of mind. He looked at the instruments on the side table. "Are you a corn cutter?" was all he could say. "Excuse me, sir," returned the polite operator. "The term you use is quite obsolete in our profession." He rose from his knees and added modestly, "I am a chiropodist." "I beg your pardon." "Don't mention it. You are not, I imagine, in want of my professional services. To what motive may I attribute the honor of your visit?" By this time, Mr. Rayburn had recovered himself. "I have come here," he answered, "under circumstances which require apology as well as explanation." Mr. Zant's highly polished manner betrayed signs of alarm. His suspicions pointed to a formidable conclusion, a conclusion that shook him to the innermost recesses of the pocket in which he kept his money. "The numerous demands on me," he began. Mr. Rayburn smiled. "Make your mind easy," he replied. "I don't want money. My object is to speak with you on the subject of a lady who is a relation of yours. My sister-in-law, Mr. Zant exclaimed. Pray take a seat. Doubting if he had chosen a convenient time for his visit, Mr. Rayburn hesitated. Am I likely to be in the way of persons who wish to consult you? He asked. Certainly not. My morning hours of attendance on my clients are from 11 to 1. The clock on the mantelpiece struck the 1:15 as he spoke. I hope you don't bring me bad news, he said, very earnestly. When I called on Mrs. Zant this morning, I heard that she had gone out for a walk. Is it indiscreet to ask how you became acquainted with her? Mr. Rayburn at once mentioned what he had seen and heard in Kensington Gardens, not forgetting to add a few words, which described his interview afterward with Mrs. Zant. The lady's brother-in-law listened with an interest and sympathy, which offered the strongest possible contrast to the unprovoked rudeness of the mistress of the lodging-house. He declared that he could only do justice to his sense of obligation by following Mr. Rayburn's example, and expressing himself as frankly as if he had been speaking to an old friend. The sad story of my sister-in-law's life. Not quite. The sad story of my sister-in-law's life, he said, will, I think, explain certain things which must have naturally perplexed you. My brother was introduced to her at the house of an Australian gentleman on a visit to England. She was then employed as governess to his daughters. So sincere was the regard felt for her by the family that the parents had, at the entreaty of their children, asked her to accompany them when they returned to the colony. The governess thankfully accepted the proposal. Had she no relations in England? Mr. Rayburn asked. She was literally alone in the world, sir. When I tell you that she had been brought up in the Foundling Hospital, you will understand what I mean. Oh, there is no romance in my sister-in-law's story. She never has known or will know who her parents were or why they deserted her. The happiest moment in her life was the moment when she and my brother first met. It was an instance, on both sides, of love at first sight. Though not a rich man, my brother had earned a sufficient income in mercantile pursuits. His character spoke for itself. In a word, he altered all the poor girl's prospects, as we then hoped and believed, for the better. Her employers deferred their return to Australia so that she might be married from their house. After a happy life of a few weeks only, his voice failed him. He paused and turned his face from the light. Pardon me, he said. I am not able, even yet, to speak composedly of my brother's death. Let me only say that the poor young wife was a widow before the happy days of the honeymoon were over. That dreadful calamity struck her down. Before my brother had been committed to the grave, her life was in danger from brain fever. Those words placed in a new light Mr. Rayburn's first fear that her intellect might be deranged. Looking at him attentively, Mr. Zant seemed to understand what was passing in the mind of his guest. You are listening to KHDX 93.1 FM, Conway, Arkansas. We are coming up on the end of the Ouroboros Steiner. We're not quite halfway through, I'd say a little over a quarter, maybe. Actually, a third. We're on page 10 out of 30. Perfect. We're a third of the way through of Mrs. Zant and the Ghost by Wilkie Collins. We might be able to finish it next week, possibly the week after. We'll see. But yeah, back to it. No, he said. If the opinions of the medical men are to be trusted, the result of the illness is injury to her physical strength, not injury to her mind. I have observed in her, no doubt, a certain waywardness of temper since her illness, but that is a trifle. As an example of what I mean, I may tell you that I invited her, on her recovery, to pay me a visit. My house is not in London. The air doesn't agree with me. My place of residence is at Salins on the sea. I'm not myself a married man, but my excellent housekeeper would have received Mrs. Zant with the utmost kindness.
She was resolved, obstinately resolved, poor thing, to remain in London. It is needless to say that, in her melancholy position, I am attentive to her slightest wishes. I took a lodging for her, and, at her special request, I chose a house which was near Kensington Gardens. Is there any association with the gardens which led Mrs. Ant to make that request? Some association, I believe, with the memory of her husband. By the way, I wish to be sure of finding her at home when I call tomorrow. Did you say, in the course of your interesting statement, that she intended, as you supposed, to return to Kensington Gardens tomorrow? Or has my memory deceived me? Your memory is perfectly accurate. Thank you. I confess I am not only distressed by what you have told me of Mrs. Ant, I am at a loss to know how to act for the best. My only idea at present is to try change of air and scene. What do you think yourself? I think you are right. Mr. Zant still hesitated. It would not be easy for me just now, he said, to leave my patients and take her abroad. The obvious reply to this occurred to Mr. Rayburn. A man of larger worldly experience might have felt certain suspicions, and might have remained silent. Mr. Rayburn spoke. "Why not renew your invitation and take her to your house at the seaside?" he said. In the perplexed state of Mr. Zant's mind, this plain course of action had apparently failed to present itself. His gloomy face brightened directly. "The very thing," he said. "I will certainly take your advice. If the heir of St. Sallins does nothing else, it will improve her health and help her to recover her good looks. Did she strike you as having been, in happier days, a pretty woman?" This was a strangely familiar question to ask, almost an indelicate question under the circumstances. A certain furtive expression in Mr. Zant's fine dark eyes seemed to imply that it had been put with a purpose. Was it possible that he suspected Mr. Rayburn's interest in his sister-in-law to be inspired by any motive which was not perfectly unselfish and perfectly pure? To arrive at such a conclusion as this might be to judge hastily and cruelly of a man who was perhaps only guilty of a want of delicacy of feeling. Mr. Rayburn honestly did his best to assume the charitable point of view. At the same time, it is not to be denied that his words, when he answered, were carefully guarded, and that he rose to take his leave. Mr. John Zant hospitably protested. "Why are you in such a hurry? Must you really go? I shall have the honor of returning your visit tomorrow, when I have made arrangements to profit by that excellent suggestion of yours. Goodbye. God bless you." He held out his hand, a hand with a smooth surface and a tawny color that fervently squeezed the fingers of a departing friend. "Is that man a scoundrel?" was Mr. Rayburn's first thought after he left the hotel. His moral sense set all hesitation at rest, and answered, "You're a fool if you doubt it." Five. Disturbed by presentiments, Mr. Rayburn returned to his house on foot by way of trying what exercise would do toward composing his mind. The experiment failed. He went upstairs and played with Lucy. He drank an extra glass of wine at dinner. He took the child and her governess to a circus in the evening. He ate a little supper, fortified by another glass of wine, before he went to bed. And still those vague forebodings of evil persisted in torturing him. Looking back through his past life, he asked himself if any woman, his late wife of course excepted, had ever taken the predominant place in his thoughts which Mrs. Ant had assumed, without any discernible reason to account for it. If he had ventured to answer his own question, the reply would have been, never. All the next day he waited at home, in expectation of Mr. John Zant's promised visit, and waited in vain. Toward evening, the parlor maid appeared in the family tea table, and presented to her master an unusually large envelope sealed with black wax, and addressed in a strange handwriting. The absence of stamp and postmark showed that it had been left at the house by a messenger. "Who brought this?" Mr. Rayburn asked.
"A lady, sir, in deep mourning."
"Did she leave any message?"
"No, sir."
Having drawn the inevitable conclusion, Mr. Rayburn shut himself up in his library. He was afraid of Lucy's curiosity and Lucy's questions if he read Mrs. Zant's letter in his daughter's presence. Looking at the open envelope after he had taken out the leaves of writing which it contained, he noticed these lines traced inside the cover. "My one excuse for troubling you, when I might have consulted my brother-in-law, will be found in the pages which I enclose. To speak plainly, you have been led to fear that I am not in my right senses. For this very reason, I now appeal to you. Your dreadful doubt of me, sir, is my doubt too. Read what I have written about myself, and then tell me, I entreat you, which I am, a person who has been the object of a supernatural revelation, or an unfortunate creature who is only fit for imprisonment in a madhouse." Mr. Rayburn opened the manuscript. With steady attention, which soon quickened to breathless interest, he read what follows. We're just about out of time for the day, so we'll have to find out what her odd experiences were next week. We do have a couple minutes left, though. So, I don't know if you can tell, but I'm a bit of a fan of Carly Rae Jepsen, actually. I'm gonna let her play us out for today. Another new song of hers, Talking to Yourself. Hope you enjoy, and I hope to see you again next week.
Are you thinking of me?